Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Dutch and Scott Sportscast. Today we have a special guest. My name is Matthijs and with me is Rory.
Today, as Matthijs said, we've got a special guest, which is Matthew Barrett, who's a co-founder of GoalClick. How are you, Matthew?
Very well. Thank you for having me, guys.
No problem. This is something we're looking at doing a lot more of in the future, bringing on football-related guests. But we're going to firstly start off with just asking Matthew, what is GoalClick? What are the aims of GoalClick?
Great. So, yeah, as you said, I'm the co-founder of GoalClick, which is a global football storytelling project. We find people from every country in the world and we ask them to tell their own story through the lens of football. So it's very much asking fascinating people with compelling stories from around the world to tell it themselves, give them the control, the power, the freedom to tell the story of their football lives and their communities. And we provide everyone with disposable analog cameras to do this. And they also write their story in their own words to accompany those photos. So yeah, it's finding great people, real people, and giving them the freedom and control to tell their own story to the world.
Brilliant. I mean, just looking at the GoalClick website, there's some brilliant projects. I'm sure Matthijs agrees with that, Matthijs, yeah?
Yeah, for sure. It seems like such a noble project. And I was just amazed by the scope of it already.
Yeah, we've been going for 6 years. So it started in 2014 with a slightly crazy idea, as all good things do. And we wanted to find someone from literally every country in the world and get their perspective. I think that what football does, because it is so universal and is so well understood by so many people, that it can frame a situation and help people understand people in a country, in a society, in a culture in a way that is quite difficult to otherwise, because it's such a common game, and the moment you see it you get a window into another person's life and community. So we used football for that reason, and it's in every corner of the world ultimately, isn't it? Maybe with the exception of maybe of Antarctica, which we are still looking for, it's that great, not a unifier, but it's so ever present that it allows us to really get an insight into other people's lives. So yes, we started in 2014. Sierra Leone was our first country that we worked in. We sent disposable camera out to a church minister and football coach of the National Amputee Football Association in Sierra Leone, a man called Pastor Abraham Bangura, and received the photos back, and they were incredible, captivating, compelling, beautiful, with an amazing story behind it of civil war survivors reintegrating into society.
Yeah, I love this.
And yeah, that.
Sorry. Yeah, I love this subject of unifying because of with football. And like another prime example of that is maybe if you know in the First World War, the Christmas truce, it was well known that the Germans and the English had played this football match together, and it's like uniting different cultures in this way. It's such a beautiful thing to see.
Do you want my honest opinion on that?
Go for it, yeah.
I hate it.
Oh, really?
I hate that story because I'm a big believer in football as something that can bring people together. But ultimately, the next day, everyone went back to fighting each other and it did no good whatsoever. So I'm a believer in football as a tool for reconciliation, reconstruction, particularly in conflict zones. And I think that story is actually the antithesis, really, of a lot of what I believe sports power to be. Yes, it showed that it's possible, but ultimately it did nothing. I actually studied sport and politics and war throughout the 20th century, so I'm very, very familiar with that story. And yeah, I just think it's actually, when you really dig deep into it, it's quite a sad, depressing version of how sport can bring people together. And yeah, I often, as you may have heard me just say, I do stop short of treating football like this grand unifying vision that if you give someone a football, everything will be okay. Look, obviously, football does have a power to bring people together in a way that very few things do. But I prefer to think of it as a common language that everyone talks and understands, not necessarily bringing everyone together in a kumbaya moment. So yeah, that's how I see the world anyway.
I understand. I mean, that's the first time I've heard that, but it does make sense. I do get where you're coming from with that.
You don't have to agree.
No, I do. I mean, I can see obviously the fight right back after it. It wasn't in hindsight in the long run, I can buy a moment. It's probably significant from a human level of who was fighting in the war, but less in that kind of overall what actually happened sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I agree as well, yeah.
But, like, it was, you know, football, as you say, it's a universal language. You know, for example, with myself and Matthijs, it was football how we met through playing football on a campsite in Brittany in France. So, amazing. As a unifier over all on that front. I wonder, do you know off the top of your head how many countries so far you've
had? Of course. So, after Sierra Leone, in the first couple of years, we got cameras back from about 15 countries. So it was quite a slow process to start with. But since then, it's really exploded. And we've published stories from over 80 countries. And we are working in about 120 countries right now. So we have a very wide scope across all the continents, into every type of country, and with every type of person. You know, it's a very even split, male and female. In fact, if anything, we probably tell more female focused stories, and all different parts of society. So from the very lowest ends of society and refugee communities and communities scarred by war and conflict, right the way up through the grassroots game into football fan culture and into the elite side of professional football. So yeah, lots of countries, lots of different people, lots of different perspectives.
That's incredible. And the probably one project that kind of shows that especially is Qatar, when you're looking through the photos from the Qatar World Cup project, and the range almost of different people that you've got photos of. You've got, you know, children playing in the streets, you've got men in a working uniform having a kick about on what you can presume is a break, and then you've got Xavi taking corners in the Qatari Super League. What was your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's something we're doing a lot more of these days. So obviously we started the project as a real global project. So we didn't want to focus too much on any specific countries. We wanted a real global spread to tell the story of the world through football and help people understand each other through the game. Over the last few years, we've started to focus a bit more on some specific countries, some specific cities, some specific tournaments, some specific issues in the world that all can be told through football, particularly in places which are interesting, intriguing, divisive, maybe. So we started with Russia and then we did Qatar in 2019. And yeah, look, Qatar is in the news constantly for many reasons, not least the fact that the World Cup is going there in 2022. And clearly there are significant issues with the awarding of that tournament. Not just the awarding, but how it's obviously being built. And, you know, there was a lot of justifiable scrutiny on that World Cup. I think where we saw our role as being was, you know, there was a big vacuum in the middle where, on the one hand, you have the Qatari authorities obviously presenting a very positive picture to the world. You know, they are doing some interesting work out there. On the other hand, you have a very sceptical and hostile Western media and kind of international community, albeit, you know, there are lots of organisations who are now working very closely with the Qatari authorities. So, you know, you get that back and forth. But we felt that the people themselves were not being heard from. And I think that's really what we try and do. We try and get the people themselves who are living the experience to tell the story from their own perspective. So we wanted to go into Qatar and let the Qatari people or expats and workers who are living in Qatar to give their version of events. And you don't hear much of that. You know, it's not something that you come across much. I had never personally heard a Qatari person's viewpoint on the World Cup and on football culture in Qatar. And I think there were a lot of football-based myths that we could maybe bust. You know, the temperature, whether they have a football culture at all, are their team going to be a joke? Do women play football? Like, all of these things were, you know, had narratives around them that weren't necessarily accurate, you know, based upon what we have seen and what we have been kind of shown by the people living there. There's a thriving women's football culture. There is an incredible grassroots program and elite program that means Qatar will probably do quite well in their own World Cup. It's not too hot to play football. obviously it is in the summer, but not at the time it's going to be played. And, you know, there is a real love for football in Qatar. And, you know, whilst all the other elements still need to be discussed around human rights and around issues of governance, you know, from a pure community perspective, it was really fascinating to get a proper insight into the country.
Yeah, so for, like, the Western media, of course, always likes to portray and frame the Qatar World Cup in a quite negative way. Mm-hmm. And your aim is not to deny any of the facts, but just to prove and show that there's a different side to the story. And there's also people with different perspective on the story.
Correct. I almost don't need to say anything more than that. Yes, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, I think that there's a danger often in our world of whitewashing out voices and silencing voices and not hearing them. Because they don't fit into a narrative. And, you know, why isn't the voice of a 14-year-old girl in Qatar a valid voice in terms of her perspective on the game and the World Cup? You know, things are not black and white. Things are incredibly grey in this world, incredibly grey in football. Like, if you want to do anything in football, you know, you are very, very close to problematic issues. Like, with every single club, like, with every single organisation, with every single tournament. And I think if you think that there's no politics involved in football, you're living in a dreamland. Every football club has, if you'd look hard enough, will have troubling links. And, you know, every World Cup is no different. So, no, we are not denying, we are not trying to whitewash a story. We're just saying there's a huge amount of people who are not getting their voices heard. And yeah, we want to give that platform to the ordinary people in a country.
Yeah, I mean, reading some of the stories, there's a few ones I mentioned, like almost impact on the culture as a whole. The announcement of the World Cup has been in Qatar. A lot more people getting into football, a lot more football clubs being founded. What from the stories would you say basically is the best kind of that covers all the bases that you were trying to cover, if you get where I'm coming from? Is it which one of the stories from it?
An individual story, you mean?
Yeah, from the Qatar project would kind of cover everything. Yeah. You were trying the best one to cover everything.
I mean, to be honest, I believe this mostly. I'm always more interested in the female-focused stories that we cover, because, you know, in every single country in the world, it is harder to play football as a woman than it is as a man. Now, I'm not saying that it's easy and as a man sometimes, and I'm not saying that men don't have incredibly difficult lives around the world in certain in many situations, but absolutely is undeniable that being female adds another layer and another barrier to playing. So hearing the stories from women who are part of the project, often Qatari women, but also sometimes from other countries, and the opportunities to play at club level, at national level, at community level is amazing and inspiring, and I'm always amazed by the resilience and the courage of women in countries where it's often not encouraged to play football. I'm always amazed by their ability to do it. So I was, rather than picking up one in particular, I think the female storytellers that we worked with in Qatar did some amazing work and told some really fascinating stories.
Yeah, and speaking of, you know, their focus on the female game, etc., one other big project that Clark have worked on is the Women's World Cup, which was an incredible project, and I was wondering how that came about.
Yeah, the Women's World Cup came really into view for us about a year before it started. So hot off the heels of the Russian World Cup in 2018, we wanted to do a big project focused on the Women's World Cup. We felt that at the time it wasn't getting any exposure. I mean, it really wasn't. I think now we are given a lot more information and we see a lot more about the women's game. But honestly, in the summer 2018, no one was talking about it. We really wanted to do a bit of a landmark series around the state of the global game at all levels, from grassroots and youth all the way up through professional and international football. But for us, given it was the Women's World Cup, we wanted to find as many of the international players as possible to be part of the project. So in the end, we worked with about 45 women around the world, about 25 of which were internationals and 18 of which played in the Women's World Cup, representing teams such as Thailand, Jamaica, all the way up to England and the US women's national team, where we had a couple of players, Sam Mewis and Kelly O'Hara, take part. And it was really fascinating to see a perspective of the game from the inside. It felt like a very intimate project. It felt like we were really seeing a window into the behind-the-scenes lives of top international athletes. But also it shone a light on the bad sides, you know, the lack of investment, the lack of infrastructure and facilities, the uncertainness of life as a elite women's footballer. But it also showed the camaraderie and the positive aspects of the game. So we felt it was probably our best and most successful project ever. Because we're working with high-profile names, but really showing a completely new side of the world of women's football to an international audience. And we're very grateful to partner with the New York Times, with Copper 90, to launch that project just ahead of the Women's World Cup and exhibit it for a month in France. And, yeah, it's got a lot of positive feedback.
Did you personally notice a big difference between the players, for example, for the United States and the players from Thailand in their professionalism, huge, their athleticism, or anything else?
Huge. I mean, I would say, obviously, the US women's national team are at the vanguard of everything positive and progressive for women's football. But actually, the US women's national team have more in common with the US men's team than they do with many of the other women's teams. The gulf between the top women's teams, you know, the top 5 or 6, 7, 8, and the rest is unbelievable in terms of investment, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of facilities, in terms of support, financing, etc. And, you know, a lot of the teams that played in the World Cup, Thailand, Jamaica, Nigeria, there are well-known issues around investment and lack of payment. And yeah, it's a really different world, even within the World Cup, in a way that you wouldn't get in the men's game. Yes, there's clearly better and worse nations in the men's game, but the level of inequality within the women's game, as well as between the men's and women's game, is really vast, and it was definitely brought out by the project.
Yes, again, similar to Qatar, the range, as you say, is incredible. From everything from grassroots women's football right up to the US women's team. And you do get a sense looking through the photos of a different level of just raw passion for the game that you don't see in behind the scenes photos of men's game.
I agree. I mean, it's a much more guarded world, the men's game, at the moment. And look, I think the women's game will get there as well. The women's game is on a path to being what the men's game is now, we hope. But right now, there is definitely that a bit more warmth, access, and openness around the women's game that you don't necessarily get in the men's game. I think that a lot of women's footballers have entered women's football because they love it and because they're finding friendship and, financial considerations haven't really come into it. I don't think you find as many pure friendships in the men's game as you probably do in the women's game at the moment. But, also I do think that hopefully that's going to end in the women's game because it's becoming more professional and we're going to get out of this slightly, we don't want to be having this narrative of like, oh, these women battled against all odds and got no support and they're only doing it because they love the game. Hopefully by 2023 that conversation's over because the game has been supported and players can just play because they're athletes, not because they love the game. So hopefully this is the last time we can do a project like this because the game has been supported properly over the next 3 or 4 years.
And do you think the strides being taken at the minute in order to develop the women's games are in the right direction?
I'm not an expert, but from what I see and what I'm told by the women themselves and by people within the game is that there was real progress being made. Coronavirus and our current situation has hit women's sport really hard and it's not been supported to the same level as men's sport has been. So, I am worried that we are undoing some of the gains we made over the last year or two. But hopefully the foundations are strong enough to get through it. But no, it's come at a really bad time for the women's game. Thank God it didn't come before the 2019 World Cup because, the 2019 World Cup was a real success and has really propelled the game on. But yeah, I think most people would say that we are amidst a setback for world sport, but a particular setback for world women's sport.
Yeah, honestly as well, for speaking from a Dutch perspective, women's football has grown immensely in the last few years, but it needed a 2017 European Cup win and a 2019 World Cup final performance for to gain real traction. And currently with the current COVID-19 situation, it's getting a real big hit with the league, the domestic league, being in trouble, and women's football needing to get back out there again after making such a big step.
Yes, completely. And in England, clearly this summer was meant to be the men's and next summer is meant to be the women's Euros. It's all been put back a year. The women's Euros in the UK could be huge for the sport because there's nothing that the British people like more than hosting an international sporting event. I think that's going to be a real success when it comes about. But yeah, it's a real shame that everything has kind of been, we've lost a year essentially in every way.
It's the same up here in Scotland. The 2019 World Cup was the first time in my lifetime I've ever seen a Scottish national team in a major final. So it was huge for us up here, even though we didn't make it past the groups. And it was really good to see. And since then, in the leagues, a lot of clubs like Celtic and Rangers have put real investment into the women's games, giving out professional contracts and stuff. But on the flip side to that happening, established women's teams like Glasgow City, for example, who don't have the funding of Celtic's professional women, etc., are taking a real hit with these professional contracts being handed out. And the history behind Glasgow City, they're by far the most successful women team in Scotland.
Yes.
they've taken a real hit over the head of it, and I wonder how what the infrastructure of women's football, in terms of its history up till now, how much that will shift with professional teams wanting to set up professional women's teams, if you get me.
It does feel like the likes of Glasgow City and teams that maybe were from slightly lower league sides are going to find it really tough to continue to exist when Real Madrid and Manchester United are now properly financing women's teams. You know, maybe in an alternate universe, there could have been a world where the women's game was totally separate. But it feels like the road we're on is that once the big clubs in men's football start financing their women's sides properly, I feel like we're on a road here to the top six in the UK, the top six in England and the top two in Scotland mirroring each other from a men's and women's perspective. And it's a sad footnote to the game for sure. Like, Glasgow have done a fantastic job over the years to be such a powerhouse in the game, but I don't feel too optimistic for them to be winning championships once the bigger sides get their acts together.
Well, honestly, same thing can already be seen with many countries. With France, you have Lyon, which is arguably the biggest club in women's football currently, and then in Spain with Barcelona and Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid. And here in the Netherlands as well, with PSV and Ajax currently being the top two in women's football.
Money talks, right? I mean, it's always, maybe I'm a bit of a fatalist around football, but ultimately, I believe that the league position in every single league is ultimately long-term decided by your revenue. And you can fume and you can argue and you can debate and you can say this and that and managers and whatever. Quite frankly, most league tables are revenue tables. So I know that's a bit of a depressing look at the world of football, but, you know...
It's the way we currently have to look at football, I think.
If it's a capitalist model, then that's going to be what it's going to be. So why, at times, what's the point? I mean, we already know that next year, Liverpool, Manchester City, Manchester United and Chelsea... are going to be the top four. So what's the point? You know, give or take a position or two and the odd, you know, well-managed club like a Wolves or a Sheffield United breaking in, like I can already tell you mostly what the table's going to be. So why won't that happen in women's football?
It's probably good for women's football as a whole because it will be getting much more investment from the big men's clubs, but it's a shame almost for the integrity of the core of the women's game, the clubs that have been there for years, etc. It's a shame to see have to spread out from them, but I guess it has to be done in order to develop the game. Because professional contracts is a game changer in women's football. It was only really a thing in America prior to now in England.
And ultimately, we need to prioritise that ahead of nostalgia. So exactly. I know it sounds brutal, but you know, it's you have to have the right investment. And if other people are coming in and are giving that investment, then that on balance is a good thing.
Exactly. I'll say the same as the Qatar one and the women's project. Is there a specific story that you would recommend for someone to read to kind of, you know, like your I wouldn't say favourite, but what one would you recommend to someone? If you had to pick one,
I'd call out two. The US women's national team, Sam Mewis, took some incredible photos of the superstars of the US team, like Alex Morgan, Rose Lavelle, Megan Rapinoe, in their training camp just before the Women's World Cup. And that's got some beautiful photos with a great story. And then we've worked very closely with a Thailand striker called Miranda Niles. Who was actually a college student until a month before the Women's World Cup, I mean, talk about a preparation difference. You know, most players, when they're off their first World Cup, are in training camps for months, and like that's all they're focusing on. She was writing a thesis on sex work until a month before the tournament started, and train on her own for the majority of it in squash courts, and kind of like just keeping herself fit. You know, she exemplifies the state of the women's football game at the moment. Just to clarify, she's half American, half Thai, but she plays for Thailand. We did a film with her as well. So we have a short Instagram film about her preparation for the Women's World Cup, which she documented herself. So yeah, I check out Miranda's story as well as Sam Lewis from the US Women's National Team.
Incredible definitely. The Sam Lewis is the first one you see when you go into the women's one, and it's instantly it catches your eye because it's Alex Morgan, the most most famous women's footballer, and it's the sort of image that you wouldn't see. Would you say that because it's disposable cameras you send out? Would you say the fact that disposable cameras kind of changes the element of the photo in a way?
I think it does. I think that we often say with that Sam Lewis photo that, first of all, only a teammate could have taken it because of the intimacy and the relaxedness of the photo. But I also think that people react differently to smartphones than they do to kind of film camera. We have a lifestyle of, you know, posing and manufacturing our smartphone photos. So we use analog disposable cameras for a few reasons. One is to kind of make everyone equal. Everyone has the same tool. Two, so that everyone is a bit more deliberate and intentional and patient with their photos. You know, there's only 27 photos on each camera, so you definitely get people thinking a bit more about what they're going to take rather than taking 1,000 photos on a phone and never looking at them again. And then third, I guess it's the aesthetic and the uniqueness and the fun. You know, let's not fun sometimes seems like a dirty word in business or like, you know, journalism. I think our photographers and our storytellers have fun using the camera because it is a bit different and it's not, you know, another selfie. So we will always prioritize our photography content as being analog. Obviously, we're moving into other media formats like podcasting and film, and with that you do need digital technology, but we think that the analog disposable cameras give a unique element to the project, not just aesthetically but the process as well, of how it works. I think it actually leads to better photos and better stories.
Yeah, the first word that comes to my mind when I see these photos is just like genuine. It just seems so real and it seems so passionate.
Yeah, we've been trying to distill down what GoalClick is for, you know, we always try to do that, but ultimately it is real people telling their own stories through football. And that means that those photos and words feel really genuine and feel really real and feel really authentic. So we don't need to manufacture or Photoshop anything because they're beautiful as they are, even if they're not perfect. Like, we like it.
Just the way they are, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The next project I want to kind of hone in on is your most recent, and it's the Refugee Project, which is another incredible project. And just again, want to know what would the idea come behind it? What's the aims? How'd it all come about?
So very early on in GoalClick's life, we realised that our narrative around GoalClick of finding people from local communities in their countries excluded refugees and asylum seekers a little bit, because by the very nature, they are not from the countries or the communities that they are currently in. So from probably about 2017, we wanted to do a specific project around refugee football and refugee storytelling. So we started building that very gradually. It's hard to work with refugee communities. It takes a lot longer. You need to build up more trust. You need to be have a high duty of care. So we did not rush it. I mean, we never rush it, obviously. You know, we're working with sending disposable cameras halfway around the world. Nothing is quick. But it was particularly patient around this. About 6 months ago, well, no, September 2019, the UN HCR, so the UN Refugee Agency, came on board to support our project and add to it as well. So obviously we've been working with lots of NGOs and charities around the world who are using football in refugee communities to help rebuild lives through football. And so we worked with many, many of them. And then also the UNHCR opened various doors for us as well to find new stories. So we launched the project in June 2020, ahead of World Refugee Day. And we launched it with 29 individuals who told their stories from refugee camps in Jordan and South Sudan and Malawi, all the way to refugees in new host communities in Europe, Australia, America, a huge range of nationalities, male and female, and really telling the story of their lives and their football communities from their own perspective. And again, you know, we talked about the barriers in the way for female footballers. You know, the barriers for refugee footballers is even more so. And if you think about the barriers for a refugee female footballer, you know, the odds are really stacked against you. So when you see Afghan girls and Syrian girls playing football, integrating into communities through football, it's amazing. The courage, the resilience is pretty breathtaking. So yeah, that's the project. It's a year-long project, so there's plenty more coming. And we're aiming to do exhibitions around Euro 21 in London and Amsterdam and hopefully some other countries as well. So yeah, I think in the end we'll probably have about 60 to 80 stories from around the world, and we're hoping for more participants all the time on that front.
I mean, one of the stories that you've highlighted before that is particularly incredible is that of Jacob Vieira.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that his story is kind of the whole going from, you know, nearly being electrocuted in his own home to become, on his way to become a professional referee in England is incredible. How did that one come about? Was it a specific had been recommended to him, or was it just by chance that you sent it out and he had an absolutely incredible story?
So, I mean, nothing is ever by chance with GoalClick. We very much make sure we know who we're working with, either individually or the organization that we're working with. So, you know, we very rarely send out a camera in hope. It's definitely always now with like rationale behind it and confidence behind it. With a lot of the other projects that we do, we often work directly with an individual. And they either apply to the project and, you know, we've crowdsourced their applications, or we've, you know, found them through connections, through fixers, through social media, etc. With the refugee project, it's a bit different, and we've gone always through organisations because there does need to be an extra duty of care with people often in very vulnerable positions. So in every situation, we've gone through a local NGO or club that works in refugee football. And in Jacob's specific case, that was with the Liverpool County FA. So as you intimated, Jacob was a professional footballer in Kenya, quite high profile. He had been targeted by drug smugglers when he was a lot younger to smuggle drugs to a international youth football tournament in Tanzania from Kenya. And he gave him the slip, but ultimately he probably had a target on his back from that moment on. And he became more famous as he started to play football in Kenya, but then ultimately was electrocuted in his own home and almost died. 3 weeks later, he went to England for a trial with Newcastle United. And after talking about his case with the club, they recommended that he claim asylum in the UK, which he did. It took 5 years for him to be granted humanitarian protection, which he now has been. But the system in the UK is that you cannot play professional football, sign a professional contract, if your case is under review. So, you know, he lost 5 years worth of his career, which kind of ended his career. So he decided to get on the track to becoming a professional referee and is progressing very, very fast through the ranks. He's probably a year or two away from potentially being a football league referee. And I think he will be one of the first professional football referees from a refugee background in the UK. So he has an amazing story. He's a very inspirational man. We've loved telling his story and we will continue to tell his story.
It's an incredible story. Overall, kind of summarise what you're kind of aiming to tell, kind of those sort of stories with this, and how football can really kind of, you know, change people and, you know, carry people through life in many ways. I mean, the one common factor through his entire life has been football. It's got him to where he is now, which is incredible. Aside from Jacob Vieira's story, is there any other stories that particularly you would recommend to someone?
I think, quite frankly, they're all worth a read. Because these are important issues and they're often very hard to understand in normal life. You know, we become slightly numb to stories of suffering, but when you read about an individual story through the context of football, it becomes a lot more relatable. So as I mentioned, I would definitely recommend reading stories of some of our Afghan girls in Austria and Australia. And I think from Jordan, the photos from a young girl called Maram, who took photos of her girls' football team in Zaatari refugee camp, are really compelling. And then also, we have a Syrian refugee participant in Germany who was a journalist in Syria and very involved with his local club. And he's basically, as he describes it, he started a love affair with a German club because he can't be with his Syrian partner. And he didn't expect to fall in love, but he has. And he's now very, you know, closely affiliated with the local club in Germany where he lives. And yeah, it's just a very powerful story of how football can help integrate and rebuild lives after, you know, very traumatic episodes. And this is a issue that grows and grows and grows. I mean, 80 million people now are displaced or refugees around the world, and that is over 1% of the global population. So more than one person every 100 is essentially a refugee, asylum seeker, displaced person. You know, there are obviously different terms, but ultimately, 1% of the world's population is displaced. So it's an important issue to cover, and using football, if it makes it more understandable for people, brilliant.
Yeah, wow, it's a very, very noble and very interesting concept. And you mentioned Euro 2021, which is coming up as a project. Is there any other projects that we need to look out for in the future?
So I think obviously the refugee project will run for the next year. The Euros project will loom soon. I think that GoalClick has always been interested in places that create debate and maybe create certain narratives that we want to challenge. the countries in the world that stand out for me right now of where football is very interesting are China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, obviously, the US, Mexico, India. These are all countries which are either hosting major tournaments in the next 5 to 6 years or rapidly developing their football infrastructure. So I could see us doing projects in those countries. I think China particularly and Saudi Arabia are fascinating right now with the amount of investment they're putting in and will bring a whole set of issues with them. And yeah, we're not afraid to lean into those countries and debates and try and find people from those places to tell that story, rather than it being left to traditional media or, you know, local government. So yeah, I think there could be some interesting projects coming along that way. I think that generally where we find ourselves at the moment, you know, there's a bit of a pivot to Asia in world football, but also with the state of the world from a health perspective, I think we might find it easier to operate in Asia for the next year or two. So yeah, but obviously the Euros is a project we really want to divert some attention to. So yeah, that's it. And but to be honest, I mean, the way we sustain ourselves is we do projects with clubs and governing bodies and brands, and we are always kind of looking for the next person to partner with around a specific topic or issue. So I probably don't even know what the next project we will be working on will be, but hopefully it will arrive in a few months' time.
And the beyond projects, is there anything going on at GoalClick or about to happen at GoalClick, any outside of projects, if you get me?
Yeah, I mean, as I've intimated, we are developing a podcast series. We are developing some short film concepts. We are looking to do live TED Talk style storytelling events. So GoalClick will expand from a format, media format point of view. And then we are starting to explore some other sports. Nothing imminent, but I feel like our style is well established now to go beyond football. And if we find the right partner, we won't be averse to moving into another sport like rugby or boxing or basketball or you know, whatever great opportunities come along. But for now, obviously, football remains the focus, and moving from just photography and written word and exhibitions into the other ways of telling stories is on our agenda.
Where can we find GoalClick online or social media?
So you can find GoalClick on Instagram at GoalClick. We're on Twitter as well at Goal_click. And then obviously the website, which is, I guess, the depository for all of the stories, is goal-click.com. But also, you know, you can Google us and lots of wonderful articles will come up.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew, for coming on today. It's been incredibly insightful into what's happening at GoalClick and you know, issues around world football. I hope you've enjoyed
being on. Absolutely, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for giving me the chance to come on, and yeah, hopefully it was insightful in some way.
Well, thank you for insightful stories. Definitely, I loved it.
Been great fun. And thanks to anyone who's listening. We'll see you next week with our next podcast.
Thank you for listening and see you soon.